It's Monday, November 27th, 2017, Masoret. Right, I left you with a question last time about if you read the description of what happened to Yaakov in terms of the deception that was practiced upon him. It's eerie and it's sort of uncanny how the similarities between what happened to Yitzchak, which was a result of Yaakov's. In other words, one could argue, because it's very tempting when people see this. See, there are certain events that may not be connected in a certain way, but people impose that. You know, they have this thing, what goes around comes around. That is, when a person experiences certain things, and it's similar to some things that he himself did, so everybody comes to conclusions immediately that that's payback. I mentioned that when we had a discussion about Hashkacha, that we have to do our best to try and detect Hashkacha as divine providence in our lives. However, we do so with, there should be an awareness that we don't know for sure. And it's a question of probability. I also emphasize that that shouldn't be the decisive factor. If something happens to a person, if it's of a negative, then it's possible that it some kind of a payback for something he did, and it's possible that it just happened. But that shouldn't really make that much difference. The way I look at it, when things happen, you should start to introspect and look into yourself. And why does it matter whether this was a punishment from God or not? Even if it wasn't, nevertheless, the thing that happened, you know, it contains within it. The fact that I did certain things wrong makes me aware. If it makes me aware of certain things, you should introspect. It shouldn't be, I don't think that should be the decisive factor. Of course, the more it appears that it is a message from God, the more substantial it's going to be, and that's going to get a person's attention. An example of that would be what's going on today, you know, with this whole explosion about the sexual misbehaviors of people in power. By the way, we shouldn't think that this is not going on in the Jewish community. I think I did mention to you that the latest issue of Tradition, that's the magazine or periodical of the RCA, used to publish articles by the Rav. Some of his most famous articles first appeared in Tradition. All right, I don't know that we have the same type of caliber in today's, not only him, but other great rabbis. It usually was a journal of philosophy and ideas and halachic reviews, things of that kind. The last issue is virtually every article has to do with the problem of abuse in the Jewish community, or the Orthodox community, and the failure to deal with it or report it, and so on and so forth. I recommend that people get a copy of it. I don't think it's that expensive. So the point is that this is... What?
$20. I ordered one.
$20?
Yep, that's what it was.
$20. Wow. Things have gotten expensive. You might be able to get it online next time. I don't know. Oh, you got it online. Wow. That's amazing. So my book is going to be inexpensive. I decided to charge $12.95 because I didn't want to make it too expensive for anyone.
Oh, my gosh.
Hey, well, so you could buy a gift. We'll see how it goes. I didn't realize it was one more thing. There's always one more thing you have to do. Last week I was saying I finished everything I have to do. And then Rabbi Borov, he's really been responsible for getting this thing through. He said that the you need to have a book description, but that's posted by Amazon. A basic description. So that's a whole. Well, how much? So he said that they allow you. I think he said about 750 words would be something like that. But don't make it long, because just make it a short and brief thing, because people, that's the first thing they'll read, a description of the book. So I hammered something out, and he made some, you know, we were hammering it up and back. And it's three small paragraphs, which he thought captures like pretty much the essence of what the book is trying to do. I also mentioned there that even though it's written from the perspective of an Orthodox rabbi, it's intended for the interest of people of all faiths and backgrounds who have any kind of an interest in the Bible. Anyways, I submitted that to him this morning, and he's going to be giving, everything is pretty much done, the covers, both covers, and he'll submit it to Amazon, hopefully by the end of the week, if everything goes well, because they have to approve of things, not the content, but the way it's set up. We'll be able to get a couple of copies. Now, there is a tendency, as I said, there's a tendency that people have to project the reasons for things whose reasons are basically unknown and can be explained, generally can be explained. Most of the things that happen to us can be explained by the Teva. Actually, I was doing this area yesterday with the Rabbi Rosenthal. It's relevant to Hanukkah. All right, so hopefully we'll do that over here too, but not today. You know, the issue of determining that something is not a matter of chance, as opposed to, okay, it could be a miracle, but maybe how do we know? Maybe it's not. All right, so please remind me to come back to that with regard to how it manifests itself with Hanukkah. But if you look at the description of the events that happened to Yaakov with regard to his marriage, he worked for 7 years, and then he was ready, prepared to, as far as he knew, he was marrying Rachel. And it turns out that it was in the morning, and it was Leah. That itself is a fascinating thing, I think, personally. I don't know where else you read something like that. That's totally contrary to everything, every romantic notion that a person has with regard to marriage. And it's not so easy, you know, to accept or to believe. Of course, we believe it, but the notion that a person gets married to the wrong woman, and that even through the night they are together, intimate in the night, and he has no idea that it's not the woman that he thought he was with. And he wakes up in the morning, and then by the light of day he sees that it's Leah. That itself is a fascinating idea. That I think most people would say is too much. That's like an extreme of tzinius, of modesty, which is, hard to believe, I would say. It doesn't fit our mentality. I can speak for myself anyways. In terms of how people operate. I tried to give some explanations years ago, but put that on the side, and if necessary, bring me back to it. Nevertheless, It's very similar that he was working for Rachel, and Yitzchak was prepared to give the brachos to Esav, and Esav went into the field, and he prepared everything, but Yaakov came ahead of him, and he put himself in the same position vis-a-vis his father. Put himself in the same position vis-a-vis the father that Leah put herself in vis-a-vis him. That is, just like he pretended to be someone that he was not, that is Esav, so too Leah pretended to be someone that she was not, i.e. Rachel. And there was that trap, there was that deception. So it's almost inevitable that someone's going to say, yeah, he got what he deserved, measure for measure. I don't know how many remember. I know Jesse will remember that I gave what I consider a major shear on this whole topic, seeking to understand what went on, but not using the classical interpretation of Rashi. The classical interpretation that everybody learns is that Rachel did this great deed, and she gave, as soon as she saw that Leah was being chosen to be the, the wife, so she was concerned that Leah would be embarrassed, and she gave, and this also presupposes that Yaakov didn't trust Lavan, and that Yaakov had made up simonim, you know, whatever it was, passwords, whatever they made up, and that way he'd know for sure who it was, and Rachel, in this great, great act of self-sacrifice, not wanting her sister to be embarrassed, gave them over to Leah. So in that manner, Leah was able to trick Yaakov. I've many problems with that. I have many, many problems with that. And I gave a shear on it, and I wound up learning, in other words, assuming that that's a midrash, assuming that we don't have to use that midrash, how can we make sense out of it in our own terms? So I gave a shear on that. There's a statement in Bereishis Rabbah. This is like a midrash of the rabbis, which says that all that night, I'll just read the English, all that night, Jacob would cry out to her, Rachel, and she answered him. So apparently that means that she pretended to be Rachel. In the morning, he saw it was Leah. Well, this also, if you remember, I said in the when I did the interpretation, my interpretation of the story of the blessings that, because Yaakov was concerned that his father would detect him. Because he said, Ulai Yimusheni Avi, perhaps he will touch me. Because Esav had very, hairy type of skin. And Yaakov, very soft and smooth. So Yitzchak was aware of that. And see, he wasn't concerned that he would recognize, because the pasuk itself says that his eyesight was pretty much gone by then. So that wasn't a concern, that he'd recognize him visually. But the concern was, as far as Yaakov is concerned, the concern was that he would embrace him, and he could tell by the skin that it's soft. It's not Esav. Esav, and we have to assume that Yitzchak had embraced his sons on a number of occasions, and this would be a prominent feature. Okay, so the question, I don't know if everybody asks this, but the question that we asked, and I'm sure there are commentators that asked it, is that, what do you mean? He's afraid of that. What about talk, the voice? And in fact, Yaakov does say, I call Yaakov, Hayadayim Yidei Esav. The voice is the voice of Yaakov, and the hands are the hands of Esav. And, but it says, Velo Hikiro, he didn't recognize him. So the question that we asked was, does it make any sense that you would be more inclined to judge in accordance with the touch? What is more clear? What is more definitive or determinative, the touch or the voice? It should be the opposite, or at least he should have stopped. We have a big doubt over here. Because as far as the touch is concerned, that's something which can be duplicated, which, as we know, it was. But the voice, so the answer is, I gave a totally different interpretation than the classical commentary over there as well. And maybe we'll have a repeat of that. But I said then, I posited, that Yaakov was not concerned about the voice because they were twins, they were brothers, and generally they had very similar, they might have had the similar voice. And people in families generally, do tend to talk alike, to sound alike. It's a strange phenomenon because a lot of times you'll call up somebody and, you know, you'll think it's your girlfriend and the husband answers and at first glance it sounds like her. And you'll mention her name and he'll say, no, it's, you know, people, brothers. Sometimes it's very hard to tell the difference between a son and the father. Everybody begins to sound alike. Because I guess generally speaking, they're all in one family, although the husband and wife would start off with different voices. But your voice, you tend to, it's funny, you tend to adapt. The expressions, the tones, and things of that sort. So that I said that Yaakov was capable of doing. He wasn't concerned. He knew how to mimic, how to sound like Esav. But he was concerned about Ulai Yimusheni. Perhaps he will touch me.
Rabbi Mann?
Yeah.
Shmuley Moskowitz gave a shiur at Masoret about this, and he wanted to say that Hakol Kol Yaakov HaYadayim Yidei Esav was the beginning of Yitzchak. He was saying something about Kol Yisrael for the future, that the voice of Kol Yisrael would be Yaakov and the hands, like he was deciding at that time that Esav was worthy of being the Yadayim.
Yeah, exactly. I interpreted it the same way, that he wasn't talking about the boys in front of him. Like most people take it. I said the same thing. And you'll see. Well, you'll see when I give the share. You can compare it to what he said, Olav HaShalom. Okay? But I said the same thing, that he was not referring to the person in front of him. And saying, you know, this guy in front of me, his hands are the hands of Esav, but his voice is the voice of Yaakov. He was not saying that. Okay. I agree. So, what's going on over here? So Chazal is saying that he saw in the morning that it was Leah. He said to her, what is the trickery you pulled on me? So according to the Midrash, he gives her an argument. She said to him, is there ever a teacher with no students? That's like a cryptic statement. What does she mean? That is to say, you're the one, you set the mode, you're the teacher, so there's going to be students. Did not your father call out Esav? And you answered him? Yeah, who are you, my son? He said, I'm your Esav, your firstborn. So too, you called out to me the wrong name, in other words, Rachel, and I answered you. So what do you make of that Chazal? Is that Chazal saying that, as many people believe that they're saying, that Yaakov was really wrong, was wrong to lie to his father, and that he got what he deserved, measure for measure. And that is that if we are to take this at face value, and this is Leah's defense, you're the teacher, so don't complain. What kind of a defense is that for Leah? Then, she's saying, in point of fact, he's asking her, how could you do this? What have you done to me? And she's saying, well, I did the same thing you did. Do two wrongs make a right? What kind of a defense? And if I'm Yaakov, I would have said, forget about what I did. What about what you did? And who are you to mete out measure for measure? That is to say, would this be, we're talking about the avos, the patriarchs, the matriarchs, and their behavior should represent the highest ideals and levels. Is this the message? That is, again, I'll tell you, a literal at face value reading is very, very difficult. For this would presuppose that, I mean, Leah knew everything that transpired. How did she know? How would Leah have known what took place when Yitzchak gave out the blessings? I find that, I'm not saying it's impossible. You might say that she hadn't. There's no indication, though. There's no indication anywhere that she would know. And if she did know, And even then she would have to decide. Would she know enough? Would she know enough to know what the circumstances were? Whether it was justified or not justified? And if she regarded it as wrong, and it would be a serious wrong, then why did she want to be married to him in the first place? That also would come into question. Remember the Chazal that say that her eyes were dim. It's a little bit cryptic over there too. It says that Rachel was beautiful, and her eyes, Leah, Rakos, very tender. I don't know exactly how to translate it, or even what's being communicated. I'm not really sure. It doesn't say that she wasn't pretty. It extols the beauty of Rachel. Then it all it mentions about her eyes. Perhaps it means that there was a certain sadness there. Because I think Chazal is picking up on that. It's funny that the beauty, when a person perceives a woman, and I guess the other way around, a man, as being handsome or beautiful, it's not only the physical. Of course, that's significant, but it is possible that some people become extremely attractive, and it has a lot to do with their personality and the way they smile. A certain kind of smile is extremely attractive, even on the physical level. And the eyes are very important, a certain brightness. So perhaps it's indicating that Leah didn't have that. Maybe she was sad. We don't know why. And maybe it's sort of, that will diminish. That will definitely diminish the attractiveness. When a person goes around with a certain sad look, even if they're physically pretty, it takes away from their attractiveness. Now Chazal, because I'm saying Chazal, say it's because she was crying. Why was she crying? Because she calculated that, she was the older daughter, and Esav was the older son, and that she would be destined for Esav and not for Yaakov, the tzaddik. She wouldn't get the tzaddik. But this would be problematic. In other words, if Chazal is saying that she desired to be married to Yaakov because he was a tzaddik, so here she's saying, you're not such a tzaddik. She's questioning him. And as I said, this would be a serious violation. This would be love unlike. That would be deception. In other words, in the case of Yaakov, you have to decide what he did. Was that legitimate or was that criminal? Because there's no in-between. It's not a minor violation. If this is wrong, then it's a violation. It's major because he's deceiving his father. He's stealing something which does not belong to him. And it's very, very consequential because it has to do with the future of Klal Yisrael. So if he did the wrong thing on that, it's extremely problematical. So what do you think, though? Is that what Chazal's judgment is? Again, if that is the case, I still want to know how Leah justifies it. You can't criticize a person. You can't defend an action that you took, which is illegitimate and defenseless, by saying, well, you did something like that yourself. So what? I would say, none of your business. Well, what does that have to do with anything? We're talking about what you just did. Are you then admitting that you did the wrong thing? And this is just the defense? Yet the Medrash does not mention that. All right, so what Esther is saying makes sense. And that is that there's more to it than just criticizing Yaakov. Because that wouldn't be justifiable. You can't justify your own misdeed by pointing to somebody else's. But that, she was trying to communicate, he should see it in a different light. And that is, he was in a similar situation, and he had no choice but to, distort the facts, the actual facts, to claim that he was Esav. But he had to do that for a higher purpose, so that he ought to understand that sometimes you're the teacher. You taught us that sometimes a person cannot stick with the literal truth and has to consider other factors as well. So basically, that's the way you should look at me, that there were other factors as well. It's not so simple as it appears. So she's sort of hinting. That's good reading. That's a good reading. I like that. But still, bear in mind that the behavior of Leah is very difficult to understand, according to the classical way. And the behavior of Rachel, in my opinion, is even more difficult to understand. But I'll come back to that when I give over that cheer. But I would say as follows. See, my first reaction to a midrash like this is that you can't rely on a midrash when it comes to making a determination as to whether one of the characters in the Torah has acted correctly or incorrectly. That's not to say that, you know, everything that the patriarchs did is perfect. You know, a simplistic idea. Well, no, they're human beings and they're definitely capable of doing the wrong thing. However, when they do, if they do something which is obviously wrong, so then it's there. I mean, there's nothing to really talk about. But when they do something which it's not clear, could be wrong, we don't understand it. So generally, the Torah itself will make it clear. It's going to emerge from the Torah. Now, bear in mind, the question we have is, did Yaakov do the right thing or the wrong thing when he pretended to be Esav and thereby usurped the brachos that were intended for Esav? It seems to me that you have to conclude that he did the right thing. If you say that he did the wrong thing, first of all, then he's not the Rasha, then it's Rivka. It was Rivka's idea. Yaakov was reluctant. Yaakov was reluctant only because, practically speaking, he was afraid that he would be caught and that his father would curse him. And Rivka reassured him and said, the curse will be on me, which I guess I take to mean that she would accept full responsibility and he would be absolved in the eyes of his father. Having said that, so Yaakov went along with it. Now, taking a look at the story itself, is there any indication that the judgment of the Torah is that he was wrong? Because bear in mind, he was found out. He was, because as soon as, the timing was very, very delicate. It's fascinating. He had to act quickly before Esav returned, and he did, and it worked out. Everything worked out favorably. And then, as soon as he left, so then Esav comes in. And then he has the whole discussion with Yitzchak. And Yitzchak is shocked. Because he had no... Again, if you read the verses that he was really in doubt as to who this person was, the voices, that he thought this person's voice was Yaakov's and the person's skin was Esav's, the hands, then why was he so shocked? He wouldn't have been that shocked, because he himself wasn't, he had suspicions. But obviously he had no suspicions. And then he was shocked. And then he said, your brother came with cunning, and he took your blessings. And then he said clearly, who was this one? Gam Baruch Yeh. Now if Yaakov did the wrong thing, and he had no right to do what he did. Well, first of all, how do you steal? Then it wasn't intended for you, and you know it's not going to stay with you. But Yitzchak didn't take them back. Yitzchak did not take them back, nor did he ever. He said, this is the right, now I see it's the right thing. Basically, that's what he's saying. He recognized, it said he trembled, a tremendous trembling. He had a moment of recognition that he was wrong, that he had made a big mistake, and that what had been done was the correct thing. And he confirmed the blessings. And not only that, but before he leaves, before Yaakov leaves, so then Yitzchak confers upon him the blessings of Abraham, which means that he's speaking about the leadership in terms of the spiritual. Whereas the brachos were really the brachos, the leadership in terms of the physical aspect, the material aspect of Klal Yisrael. So we never ever see, it never comes up anywheres in the Torah that he did the wrong thing. Now, as far as other, for example, in the case of, the Torah does point out certain flaws of Yaakov's, for example, when he favored Yosef. So that was wrong. He favored Yosef and he was sort of oblivious to a certain extent to the animosity that developed. He didn't handle it properly. In fact, he's the one who sent Yosef on that mission to see how his brothers are doing on that fateful day. How could he have done so if he truly recognized the danger? He was sending him right into the face of danger. So clearly that was wrong. The Torah is not trying to whitewash anyone. And any other averos that are done by the greatest people, it's pointed out. When David sins with Bathsheba and puts Uriah into the battle, into danger, then the Torah makes it clear. God sends a Navi. He gets criticized, gets condemned. He suffers as a result of it. So that when subsequently his own son rebels against him, subsequently he experiences, and one of them is killed. David paid a tremendous price. He suffered tremendously. And Tanakh is pointing out that it has to do with his sins. So I would say the same thing over here. There's no indication at all that Yaakov did the wrong thing. He did it because Yitzhak was being deceived, had made a major mistake about the character of Esav. And had Esav assumed that role in the future of Klal Yisrael, it would have been an absolute disaster. That's what Rivka saw. Rivka had a clearer insight into the nature of Esav than Yitzchak had. Whatever the reason, it doesn't make any difference. The truth is the truth. And she recognized that you can't be passive in a situation like this and just let things go forward and we'll work it out later. She says, no, we've got to nip it in the bud. I always refer to her as the most proactive of the Imos. And she was stymied by the fact that with regard to this matter, she didn't have the ability to convince Yitzchak. It's different. Whereas Sarah would confront Avram and say, get rid of Yishmael. He's no good. He's a danger. And Avram disagreed, then Hashem intervened. But that wasn't the nature of the relationship between Rivka and Yitzchak. So she had no choice. She did what she did. Yaakov did, and they did a good thing. They did a good thing. Now, I pointed out the Rashi. That Rashi says, Anochi, I am the one who's bringing. Esav b'chorecha. Rashi, at first glance, seems to be, arranging the word so that he really didn't lie, which I said doesn't make any sense if you learn it that way. And I just explained that it meant from a psychological standpoint that Yaakov did his utmost not to enable him, allow himself to derive any enjoyment or benefit from the lie. But there's no doubt in my mind that Yaakov did not do the wrong thing. Hold on. That's my position, that there's no indication. Yaakov remains. If he made it such a major, why did Yitzchak take the brachos away from him if it was the wrong thing to do? And he remains Yaakov. He becomes the Av. He becomes the progenitor of the Shvatim. And Esav is the one who leaves the Jewish people, separates from the Jewish people. So I don't see how something of that dimension, if it was wrong, if it was sinful, that, you know, we don't see any repercussions. Now, if that's the case, what's the story with the Chazal? The story with the Chazal seems to be, from that angle, that it is, it seems to be making that point, though, that it's Mida Keneged Mida. And I don't think the point of that, while it does, you know, it does serve that purpose, that Leah could say, well, you know, you shouldn't complain. Or, you see, the problem is going to be with Leah. I don't see that the case of Leah is that Leah finds herself in the situation, which is parallel to the situation of Yaakov. Because Yaakov's situation, he wasn't doing it for himself, because he wanted a gain as a result of this. Probably would have been happier if Esav was a tzaddik, and Esav would have been the man in control of the material, and he would have been free to devote himself completely just to the Torah. So he was doing it because his mother urged him to do it, because he had to do it, because there was a tremendous ideal over here. It's the whole future of Klal Yisrael. Now, how can Leah, what's Leah's point? What's her defense? Where's the idealism? All right, so she didn't want to be married to Esav. So don't marry him. I don't know. I mean, we don't see, when you get to the particulars, could she have avoided a marriage? There's nothing in the Chumash that indicates that that marriage would have taken place. Seems to be Chazal saying that. And I don't know where they get it from, or how marriages were done, or if she simply would have told her father she's not going to marry him.
I kind of doubt that that would have had any... I don't know that that would have worked.
If what?
If she would have... Assuming that Chazal is onto something and that was really intended, I don't know that she could have just said, I don't want to marry him, and then not married him. I don't know.
Well, we don't know.
know that that would have worked.
Yeah, but you don't know that it wouldn't. We don't know what the situation. I mean, they forced people to marry. I don't know. Esav seemed to have been in a completely different place altogether. And he never winds up with Lavan. So, I don't know. But even if that should be the case, how does that justify the lying? That's a personal concern of yours. Would that be, let's put it in our terms, would that be legit? That you would have a right to deceive someone in terms of pretending to be someone else. By the way, this really couldn't take place in our time. It couldn't take place. That is, let's say a, you know, couple gets engaged, they get married, and let's say with the consent of the bride, but she has a friend who really wants to marry this guy. So they come up with this scheme, but he doesn't really want to marry her. But he does want to marry her friend, but the friend doesn't want to marry him. This would be an interesting movie. It's a complicated scenario. So they conspire, and she, you know, they date. That is the girl that doesn't want to marry him, but that he does want to marry. And they get engaged in the wedding. Now the girl that really wants to marry him has a lot of similarities. And she knows how to dress up and so on and so forth and pretend to be her friend. And that's exactly what they do. Truth of the matter is, you could have identical twins. It would be a very interesting movie, identical twins. And, you know, I wonder if a husband, how long it takes a husband who's married to a woman that has an identical twin. Because sometimes I've known identical twins. I can't tell the difference. I can't tell the difference. And when I was in the Young Israel, there were identical twins. I mean, they were grown, okay, in their 20s. And I could never know which one was which. They could have fooled me. Okay, I didn't get to spend that much time. I saw them, you know, in shul and whatever. They work in a, they have a takeout, the family has a takeout business, so I would see them there. I'd never know which is which. I'm sure you've all met cases of identical twins. and you really can't tell the difference. Now, what about a husband? I don't believe that a husband is going to go through his life and never know which is which. But even at the beginning, he could be fooled. He could be fooled. So let's assume that she did that. The identical twin, the wrong twin, shows up in the bridal and this and that, and, you know, there's the veil anyways, and so on and so forth. And he doesn't get it because he doesn't even expect that to happen. And then he winds up in the morning. Turns out in the morning, and it was Leah. So what would happen in a situation like this? What would happen in a situation like that?
Kachtaus.
Exactly. In halacha, it's not, you can't do that. Because he never intended to marry her. That's what they call a mekachtaus. It was mistaken. It's like, you know, any deal. If I buy a car from you with the assumption that the, you know, that the engine is working and so on and so forth, and it turns out it's not true, then the whole thing is null and void. Because that was it's a kinyan. You know, marriage works as an acquisition, as a kinyan, which requires consent. She has to consent. And the man has to make the kinyan. He never had any intention whatsoever to marry that woman. It was under false pretenses, so it's null and void. There's no marriage. So therefore, it's an impossible thing to do, to achieve. So I don't think, I mean, we'll just stop here for today. I want to give another word or two on the what I think Chazal perhaps are saying over here, because it's very complicated. Because if Leah is making the point that you should understand my dilemma, you were in a similar situation, and you didn't find it wrong to misrepresent the facts, well, I was in the exact same situation. Well, I mean, you could say that. You could say that, and then it's not so bad. One way is that you could defend yourself, is to say it wasn't malicious. That is, if you understood my dilemma, then you would, because you had your own dilemma. I'm not saying mine is like yours, but if you understood my dilemma, then you would see that it's all right. Perhaps, but I do. The problem with that, as I'm saying, is I don't see that there's any ideal other than personal. The fact that you don't want to be married to Esav, assuming that that's inevitable, that's going to happen. And you're using Yaakov. What right do you have to use Yaakov to mislead him because you don't want to be married? I find that somebody has to explain the morality of that. But I do think that there is, just when you read the Chazal, she's chiding him. You're the teacher. I learned. It seems to be a bit of a rebuke against him. Like, what are you complaining about? You did the same thing. It doesn't seem to be that much, although it is, but I don't think that the main emphasis is that Leah is just trying to make some kind of a justification. If it's a justification, I think it's weak. Because you could say that, but then you got to show why your case was on a level where it warrants. His case was on a level where it warranted it. Her case is not, as far as I can see. I could be missing something here. But at any event, it does seem to be there's a bit of chiding. Like, what are you complaining about? And even there is a certain sense of a midah keneged midah, a measure for measure. Okay, but we'll explore that tomorrow, and then we'll proceed. Okay, take care, everybody. See you tomorrow. It's Wednesday, December 6th, 2017, Masoret. So we're sort of continuing the discussion. Obviously, one thing leads to another, and that's the way Torah is structured. In the course of giving a analysis, I would call it an analysis of the approach of the Midrash with regard to the deception of Yaakov. If you take it literally, that is the famous story that Rachel gave Leah the simanim. And I approached it from a purely practical standpoint, analyzing the psukim, subsequent developments, and so forth, and showing the difficulties. And then I proceeded to give an alternative explanation, which was strictly in accordance with the pshat, without any midrash. And then I said, and that yesterday we discussed the midrash, because as I said, the midrashim have to be treated very seriously. And many of them we don't understand. And it's this point has been made time and time. I think there are two important principles to remember. The first one that I discussed yesterday is that the Midrash is not a infallible source in terms of the plain meaning, in terms of the plain pshat. Because as I said, as far as I know, there's no masorah with regard to the non-halachic parts of the Torah. So every person does, in other words, what the rabbis are saying, they can mean it sometimes, that's their interpretation. That could be their interpretation in terms of the pshat, or most of the time, however, it's not pshat. It's meant to define, to add a dimension, because, you know, the Torah is very, very terse and brief, so it needs interpretation. And very often, a lot of times they'll say things that at first glance sounds outrageous. This is not what the Chumash is saying, but when you think about it, you'll see that they're bringing in a deeper idea, which you are then supposed to utilize as a way of understanding the story. So that's the first principle. Not to mention, the Rambam, all the great Rishonim, wrote that the Midrashim are not necessarily to be taken literally, and the Agadot, because if you take them literally, very often it sounds crazy. But that's not the point. The point is that they used all different types of expressions, metaphors, allegories, and so on, not intending to be taken literally, but to convey ideas, which is a whole discussion in its own right. So those are the two ideas. A, that the Midrashim are not from Sinai, they're the works of the great rabbis, and are not necessarily intended as the pshat. And B, they're certainly not always intended to be taken literally, because they contain parts which are not, or the entire Midrash is not to be taken literally, or parts of it are to be taken literally. That's a whole separate study, a whole separate science, to decipher a Midrash and to discover the true idea. The final point being that, of course, when I say that the Midrashim are true and we have to take it seriously and study them, I mean to learn the idea. The ideas are ideas of Judaism. And these are the greatest sages, and they're expressing their ideas. So that's what I tried to do yesterday, to try and understand what the Midrash is teaching us when they're telling us that this is what happened, that Rachel gave the simanim, and so on and so forth. And I gave my interpretation, that it's teaching, it's using that occasion to, that's an important point. What I believe is that very often they will use the text, because the text lends itself to teaching a certain lesson. And they'll weave it into that text that this is what happened. Meaning to say that this is very well what could have happened. Like I showed you yesterday, the idea that Yaakov hid Dina in a box. I don't know that you have to take that's factual, but it does contain an idea. Okay, so I just wanted to add another dimension to the discussion. Hopefully this will help us by citing something from the Mor Nevuchim. So if you have it in front of you, fine. If not, it's not going to be that hard to follow when I read it. And this is in, look in the Mora, the guide, that's part 3, chapter 43, in the paperback, The Friedlander, would be page, the chapter is page 352. And it actually is three pages long. Now, the basic subject of the chapter is the festivals. He takes up the significance of the Yom Tovim, the festivals, you know, the three festivals, as well as Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. We've dealt with this chapter many times over the years. A major point that he takes up is the length, the duration, why the festival is in general 7 days. That is Sukkos and Pesach. In point of fact, Sukkos turns out to be 8 days, but it's really 7 days of festival plus 1 day of Shmini Atzeres. So he addresses that too, why the Torah saw fit to add the extra day of Shmini Atzeres. And then he takes up Shavuos, says why it's only 1 day. And then he goes into the ideas, the concepts that are communicated to us on these festivals. Okay, so I'm not going to go through that part. But interesting, it's hard to figure out what the... Well, the Rambam didn't write everything in a straightforward way in the Mora, as he himself says in his introduction. And he mixed things around for various reasons, because he was dealing with subject matter that was very dangerous, so to speak. It's not for everybody. We do study the Rambam, the Mora, but we never take up the areas of metaphysics that the Rambam is referring to and says that it's not for everybody. There are many areas in the Mora which are the reasons for the commandments, for example. And he takes up ethical matters and what constitutes perfection and so on and so forth. So the areas that we've taken up are those types of areas, which are very, very beneficial. And there's no prohibition, obviously, of studying those. So now, towards the end of this chapter, which is really dealing with the purpose of the festivals, he takes the last one that he considers is Shmini Atzeres. I'll pick it up from there. That would be on page 353. We join to the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles is Sukkos. The tabernacle being a word. Well, that's the translator. The Rambam didn't write tabernacles. But he's using the word tabernacles for Sukkah. We join to the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of the Eighth Day, that Shmini Atzeres. In order to complete our rejoicings, which cannot be perfect in booths, but in comfortable and well-built houses. All these points are extremely significant. That is to say that the goal of the Torah is not deprivation. And even though we do go, we leave the homes, and we do accept upon ourselves, it's a diminished situation. A sukkah is never going to be the same thing as a house. Although it's always been my dream, if I were able to do so. You know, there are places, there are people. Today you could actually do it. You know, you have one room, a nice room, with a removable ceiling or roof, or one that opens up. And then that's all you need to do. Before Sukkot, you open it up and you put the slats across. But in point of fact, you're living in a beautiful, comfortable room with all of your comforts. So that's interesting. Halachically speaking, that's fine. But anyways, in general, though, the idea is to remember the difficult times we had, to remember the times in the wilderness when we were completely dependent upon God's protection, which is a very, very important principle in Judaism. That you know, people are always seeking to be in a state, in a situation where they feel that absolute security. And it's provided by many things, by beautiful homes and beautiful cars and lots of money. And when that's what the Torah says, so then when you have all these comforts and you feel secure and you don't really feel that you need God, so that's when you rebel. And when a person feels, well, he'll never get that feeling anyways. It's an absurdity, because man will never get that feeling, because even if you have all those things, there are certain things that they simply cannot protect you from. And that is the health. The wealthiest people are not any, yeah, they can get better medical treatment, but it's not going to prevent them from getting catastrophic illnesses. So that's the point of the, it's important for the Torah to make that point, because upon having you leave the house and give up your basic comforts, as I said, the classic sukkah is not, even today, you know, a person has his bedroom and he sleeps and he has his comforts and his TV and all those things, and you leave them and you, you know, you dwell in the sukkah. So the Torah doesn't want to leave you. The Rambam is recognizing that you're not going to be in the same state of happiness. It's good to experience these things because they teach us very profound lessons that ultimately we have to recognize that we're dependent upon Hashem. But we should take that recognition, take that realization, and utilize it for the service of God. And the service of God cannot be at its best when a person is not in the happiest state. It's a very important teaching that the Torah really, really requires that a person should be at his happiest state possible. Only in that state can he serve God properly. And that's why the Torah endorses having a pleasant life, pleasant home, pleasant furnishings, to the extent that he can afford. Not because he should be pursuing material things, but simply because they put him in a better state, a better disposition to serve God. So that's what he says, that our joy is not complete except in comfortable and well-built houses. As regards the four species, the branches of the palm tree, the citron, the myrtle, and the willows of the brook, our sages gave a reason for their use by way of a Gadic interpretation. See, now he's going to be talking about that subject, a Gadic interpretation, the method of which is well known to those who are acquainted with the style of our sages. Now listen very carefully to these words. They use the text of the Bible only as a kind of poetical language for their own ideas, and do not intend thereby to give an interpretation of the text. As to the value of these midrashic interpretations, we meet with two different opinions. Now, the mere fact that he says that indicates that they're not Mesinai. Because if they're from Sinai, there's no interpretations. Then anyone who subscribes to the Torah, the Torah Shebech Sav, Torah Shebaal Peh, would have to accept it. For some think that the Midrash contains the real explanation of the text, while others, finding that it cannot be reconciled with the words quoted, reject and ridicule it. Okay, that's not a legitimate view. So he says there are those who believe that the Midrash contains the real explanation of the text. Okay. Then he says there are others who reject it and ridicule it. Well, as I said, that's wrong. Let's continue. The former, that's the first group, struggle and fight to prove and to confirm such interpretations according to their opinion, and to keep them as the real meaning of the text. Okay, that's not the view that I said that it doesn't have to be the real meaning of the text. Yeah, you have to be careful, because, in other words, interpretation of the text and meaning of the text is not the same thing in my mind. It could be being used the same way over here. The real meaning of the text would be what I call the pshat. And the pshat is the actuality. This is what happened. The interpretation, however, is not the same thing. The interpretation in terms of what are the ideas behind it is something else. But let's just see if we can figure out what he's saying. Because he said those who are maintaining that it's the real meaning of the text, they struggle and fight to prove and to confirm such interpretations according to their opinion, and to keep them as the real meaning of the text. they consider them in the same light as traditional laws. Okay, so now we have a very clear statement. That's the way I understand that point of view. The traditional laws are handed down in the Torah Shebal Peh. This is the interpretation of the verse regarding tefillin, and you shall bind them as a sign on your arms, and this is the meaning of the work, what's considered work on Shabbos. It all comes from the oral law, an eye for an eye, and so on and so forth. That we maintain is from Sinai. Now he's saying that this first group, that pretty much I think he's saying they take it literally, they treat these midrashim just the same. The same way they treat the halachic midrashim, that's the way they treat the non-halachic midrashim. Okay, and that is not the view that I was espousing. So now let's hear the verdict of the Rambam. He's quoted two views, those who ridicule and reject, and those who go to the other extreme, not just accept, but accept it as the literal truth. Says the Rambam, we're now on page 354, neither of these two classes understood it, that our sages employ biblical texts merely as poetical expressions, the meaning of which is clear to every reasonable reader. The meaning is that it's not intended to be the meaning, it's not intended to be the meaning of the text. Okay? But they're intended as poetical expressions, the meaning of which is clear to every reasonable reader. Okay, so they're employing the text in order to get across certain ideas. This style was general in ancient days. All adopted it in the same way as poets adopt a certain style. Our sages say in reference to the words, and a paddle thou shalt have upon thy weapons. Now, is anybody familiar with that pasuk? That's in Devarim. V'yaseid tielecha al azeinecha. And that is, I would translate it as a spade. It's like a little shovel. So that included with the military gear that the Israeli soldier who went out to battle had to have, or he had to have his weapons, obviously, whatever they were in those times, whatever they used, bow and arrow, whatever, sword. In addition to his weaponry, he had to carry with him a paddle. He's calling it a paddle. It's basically a spade. And the reason for that is because when he had to go to the bathroom, so he went outside the camp and he had to dig a hole and cover it up. Now, that's a very important idea, that he has to maintain a certain level of purity, a certain level of cleanliness, and he shouldn't let himself go. In that state, a situation, he's going away from the ordinary norms of civilized behavior. You see, you know, in camps, our soldiers behave. There's a complete breakdown. And that's not a good thing, because the camp should be holy. Okay. Now, the Hebrew word is v'yaseid. He calls it a paddle. We're calling it a spade. All right? So it's pretty straightforward as to what the pasuk is saying. And it says, in the next pasuk, or in that pasuk, v'hoyah machanecha kadosh, and your camp shall be holy. Come along the rabbis, and they say, our sages say, in reference to the words, v'yaseid, and a paddle, thou shalt have upon thy weapon. Now what's the word for weapon? Azeinecha. They come along and they say, don't read it azeinecha. Azeinecha means your weapons. But azeinecha, you know, is related to another Hebrew word, which is ozen. And ozen is ear. So the rabbis say, no, don't read it your weapon, but oznecha, your ear. So you should have a paddle on your ear. Okay, so that's what it's telling you. What do you mean you should have a paddle on your ear? It means that you should cover your ear. Why? Because you shouldn't listen to bad speech. So that's what it's telling you. You should have a paddle. You are thus told that if you hear a person uttering something disgraceful, put your fingers into your ears. That's what the pasuk is telling you. So forget about this idea of having a paddle and so on and so forth. No. The yaseid is referring to your fingers. I always thought that maybe it means the lobe, the earlobes, because you could push your earlobes up into your ear and you won't be able to hear anything, which is what people do when they don't want to hear anything. They cover their ears and they start humming, and then you don't hear anything. But you didn't know that that was a command of the Torah. So it's a good idea. It's a good idea because sometimes you're caught in a situation and you can't even avoid Lashon Hara sometimes, because sometimes it comes out of nowhere. Somebody just, it springs up on you. So what are you supposed to do? Cover your ears and you won't hear it, because you're not allowed to hear Lashon Hara. You're not allowed. So, but what can I do? So, no, Hashem outfitted you. He outfitted you with the protection against that. So cover your ear, put your finger in your ear. Even though that may not be so, cosmetic or hygienic, whatever, you don't want to get your hands dirty or whatever the case may be, but it's much, much better to have to go wash your hands than rather to partake of the aveira of Lashon Hara. So there you have it. There you have it. The rabbis came and they interpreted the pasuk that way. So now the question is, are they saying that that's what the Torah is saying? Are the rabbis saying that that is really what the Torah is communicating? That's the pshat in the pasuk. So the Rambam says as follows. Now, I wonder whether those ignorant persons who take the midrashic interpretations literally believe that the author of this saying gave it as the true interpretation of the text quoted, and as the meaning of this precept, that in truth, yated, the paddle, is used for the finger, and as a necha denotes thy ear. I cannot think that any person whose intellect is sound can admit this. The author employed the text as a beautiful poetic phrase in teaching an excellent moral lesson, namely this. It is as bad to listen to bad language as it is to use it. I agree that the language is a little bit difficult, but I think what he's saying is like this. If you read the pasuk and you explain what is the pasuk saying, would you say that that's what it's saying? Would any person of sound mind say that that's what it's saying? It's clearly saying, it's talking, look at the whole context and look at the words. It's talking about a soldier. And it's telling you that he should be equipped. It's a very mundane piece of information. And you wonder, why does the Torah have to get so specific? But there's a great moral lesson over here. That great moral lesson has nothing to do with Lashon Hara. It's about maintaining discipline, personal cleanliness, in all circumstances. Now come along the rabbis and say something totally different, which is a million miles away from what the Torah is talking about. Because those words, those very, very same words, could be used in a different context to convey a great moral lesson. So they're going to say that. Don't read it this way, read it that way. Read it the other way. A way that that's not the meaning, but these very same words can be used to convey that idea. Why is that important? So what? Let's convey the idea that you should not listen to Lashon Hara. Well, why do this? Why distort something? Why distort the meaning of the words in order to teach this point? That's a good question. Anybody want to try for that? However, that I want to emphasize is that for whatever the reason they do it, it is not, it's a midrash, and it's not the meaning of the verse. It's not the meaning. Okay. Well, that's what I was saying, you know, that they use midrash to convey ideas. The reason I believe is because it's effective. These types of sayings are effective. Of course, if something, people like a play on words. People are always using a play on words. It's witty, it's funny, and it helps you to remember something. But it's a play on words. That's not what the words came for. It's akin, it's not maybe the same thing, but like I said, the four parshas, Acharei Mos, Kedoshim, Emor, those four parshas. Acharei Mos, after the death, Kedoshim is holy, Emor is say. So there's an expression, you know, whenever someone dies, and the eulogies are way exaggerated, you know, and people who know, which is something you're not supposed to do, and people who know him know that he really wasn't like that, and these people are just saying it for what, you know, they want to get in the good graces of the relative, whatever the reasons are. So they say, yeah, Acharei Mos, Kedoshim Emor. After a person dies, say he's holy. That's not what it means. That's not what anything means. It's just, it's an expression. It's an expression. When there's a contemplated, you know, there's a change in a school or a shul, whatever, and then things start to change because of the new. So they say, Vayakom Elochad Hashem Mitzrayim, and a new king arose over Egypt. So a lot of the statements in the Torah, which have one meaning, are taken out of context to convey other ideas. So this, the rabbis decided that this is a very good idea, that even though it has absolutely nothing to do with it, but there's some kind of similarity. There's a similarity because of the words. Yaseid can be taken as fingers. Azeinecha is related to ozen. So let's create a lesson, which is not what the Torah itself is telling you. They don't mean to say that this is really part of the meaning of the pasuk. They don't. It's completely separate. It's super added. But they're attaching it to psukim because it contains a moral lesson, and by virtue of that fact, you'll remember that phrase. If you remember that phrase, it'll have a bigger effect. Because when we're in that situation, and I see it's about to develop, and I say, so then the authority of the Torah will be invoked, and people will be more apt to cover their ears. The author employed the text as a beautiful poetic phrase in teaching an excellent moral lesson. You see, in other words, it's good to encapsulate something, a basic teaching. And that's what people do. They do it in all languages. They have these sayings. And they take them out of their plain meaning and a play on words, as I said, or a double entendre, things of that sort. But things of that sort have an effect upon people. So therefore, they're good tools in order to convey, they're useful to convey certain moral teachings, and they're handy. They're handy because instead of bringing out a whole book, I mean, you can't, but if you can encapsulate a profound idea in a few words, which is catchy, so then it performs a useful service. So that's what he says, that it's an excellent moral, namely this, it is as bad to listen to bad language as it is to use it. This lesson is poetically connected with the above text. So there is a connection with that text. Maybe it's a stretch, whatever the case may be. But that doesn't matter anymore. In the same sense, you must understand the phrase, do not read so, but so. In other words, al tikre. Very often, they'll quote a pasuk, and they'll say, don't read it this way, but read it that way. So again, it's because the words are connected. If you read the word a little bit differently, then it comes out that it's making a completely different statement. So what right do you have to do that? But to check, it's a midrash. They're doing it for the purpose of conveying teachings and lessons. He says, That's the way you should understand that expression, wherever it occurs in the Midrash. Then he says, I have departed from my subject, but it was for the purpose of making a remark useful to every intellectual member of the rabbinates. I now return to our theme. All right, the theme, he goes back to explaining the four species. I mean, he himself is, you know, telling us that this is an example, that he digresses from a subject, goes into a different subject, then comes back to the original. It's not always clear why he does so in this particular way. Again, I think he's doing the same thing because he was speaking about the four species and what their meanings are. And you see the rabbis employ the same thing, even with regard to the four species. And some of the, I'm sure you're familiar with some of the Midrashim, that this represents this kind of Jew, that represents the other kind of Jew, or this represents the mouth, this represents the eye, or there are some Jews that have a pleasant aroma, but they don't have substance. You know, they have Torah, but not. And there, then there's Jews, the Hadas gets the short shrift, because it doesn't have pleasant aroma and it doesn't have substance. And there are Jews like that, and you take them and you bind them together, and each one sort of atones for the other one. So that's not the pshat. That's not the reason. As I said, I'm just using that as an example of the utilization of Midrash in that context. So, now he doesn't go any further. I would summarize then, I would, you've just seen examples of Midrashim, which supposedly are telling you that the text does not mean what it says it means, but it means something entirely different. So, in those cases, they never meant to say that this is the way we understand the text. The Midrash is something which is completely separate, and we have this Midrash, we're going to look for a place. Where is there a good statement, a poetical statement in which we can hang this lesson on? That's one type of Midrash. However, there are Midrashim which do purport to be the actual interpretation. See, I'm using the terms I'm using are pshat as opposed to interpretation. So there's Midrashim which are, they may sound strange when you first read them. And where do you see that in the story? Now, for example, we're all familiar with the Midrash that the by Yaakov, when he left from Beersheva and he went to Charan and he stopped in that place. And he took from the stones of the place. And he made it as a, he made it like a pillow. He surrounded the stones around his head. And why the Torah even has to tell you that. But, and then he slept in that place. Then it says in the morning, he took the stone and he poured oil on it. Because that was after he had the dream. He had the dream that Hashem was still with him. And Hashem was going to be with him. So then, nobody, I don't think anyone would have thought of this, to make a big deal out of that. But the rabbis come along and they say, well, one second, when he took it, it was stones. And then in the morning, it was one stone. So what happened? How do you explain that phenomenon? So then you have the Midrash that the stones were fighting. On whose head should the tzaddik, I'm sorry, on whose... Whose stone, which stone should the tzaddik rest his head? That's a big kavod, that's a big honor. So they were fighting with each other. So then God came along and joined them all together. And all of them had the benefit. So does anybody in his right mind actually believe that that's the pshat? Now, in other words, are there people that believe that if you were there, or you had a camera filming it, you would see some battle going on between the stones, and then you'd see that at a certain point they became united. I can't imagine I personally can't imagine that anybody would believe that that is meant to be taken literally. And that's not, I don't think that's even an interpretation of the pasuk. The question is, but it does contain an idea. I tried to discuss this idea many times. Now, with regard to what the teaching is, that's something you have to, you know, try to analyze what they're saying. It's not that simple. But I came up with certain ideas. And it would be the same thing. That is to say that they had this teaching. They wanted to communicate. And, you know, that is just speaking broadly, that when you first start out, so there's an element of ego. People are motivated by ego. They want the kavod. Now, as long as they want the kavod, so then there's strife, because there's competition for the kavod. But at a certain point, when people reach a high level and they recognize the beauty of the ideal, so then to the contrary, then they work together. Because the greater the unity, the more the beneficial. In other words, the greater the level, if the nation is successful. See, people don't see that idea today. Today's world, you see, it's everybody's out for himself. So there's tremendous strife. And there's very little dedication to the betterment of the nation. But the truth is, if the nation benefits on the whole, then each individual will benefit even much more so. And so that's the point, that eventually we start off, there's no other way to start. Because you can't start off with Ahavas Hashem, with love of God, with love of Torah. So you have to start off with what we call Lo Lishma. So there's an incentive. And the biggest incentive is the ego. And that itself is double-edged because it causes strife and dissension. But ultimately, if you reach the level through Hashem, that's why it's Hashem that brings them together. So then there's peace, and that's the greatest good. Okay, so maybe that's not what they're... That's what the way I see it. But the point is, they don't mean to say that that's what the pasuk is saying. However, it's a good opportunity to incorporate that idea. However, there are midrashim which are significant because they help you interpret. Like, for example, the midrashim pertaining to Adam, that before the sin, the Yetzirah was mibchutz. The Yetzirah was external. And after the sin, then it became, the Yetzirah became mibifnim, became internal. So that's very, very significant in helping us to break open the basic, you know, categories, what took place in the sin of Adam. So, and then in many stories, if you understand the Midrash, and then you go back to the Pasuk, you see that they're adding a dimension, because the Pasuk is very brief, it's very terse, and so many things are being left out. So, when they're, or for example, when Rashi says, V'hunar, that about Yosef, that he was a lad, he was young, and he spent his time with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, and so on and so forth. And he brought back bad reports to his father. So Rashi says that he did, and Rashi's quoting the rabbis, that he did, vain, youthful activities. He took care of his hair, and he took care of his appearance, was very important. So that's not what the pasuk is saying. The pasuk is simply saying that he was young. And the word nah refers to a young lad. No, but they come along and say it's really talking about maaseh naros. You know, childish kind of things, or your immature kind of things. Vanity. That is a interpretation. That's not extraneous. They're saying that the pasuk is conveying more than merely age. The pasuk is conveying something about his personality. And that's a result of their study of the parsha. You study the parsha, the fact that he brought back the bad reports, and other other activities of Yosef, they are giving you an interpretation of Yosef as a young man and what flaws he had. That is truth. But I mean to say, that's not extraneous. They're not doing that because they wanted to point out that immaturity, vanity is a bad thing. That's not the case. This is a case where they had a certain understanding of Yosef and what the factors were, and that's their interpretation. That's their interpretation. Now, here's another one. In the case of in the case where Potiphar, I mean, you see the Rashi over there, because it describes Yosef's rise to power, step after step after step, and then the master gave everything in his hands. They didn't even bother to check. That's the extent of the confidence that he had in Yosef. Okay? So when that ends, after describing that, so it says that Vayhi achar hadvar me'ela. It was after these things. Now, after these things means as a result of these things. Vatisa eshes adonav esenel Yosef, and the wife of Potiphar lifted her eyes to Yosef, and she said, "Lie with me." So she tried to seduce him. Okay. So now this comes out of the blue, because he had been there before. He started working for his master in the field, and he was successful. So slowly but surely, he got promoted. All of a sudden, she discovers that he's handsome. So Rashi says, "Kivan shera atzmo moshel." Now that Yosef, as soon as Yosef saw that he was in power again, hischil ochel b'shosa, umasalsel b'saro, he began to eat and drink and work on his hair. He took care of his looks. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Avicha misabel, v'yata misalsel b'sarecha, your father is in mourning and you're like having a good time, you're worried about your looks. Ani megar v'cha sadov, I'm going to sick the bear upon you. The bear is the wife of Potiphar. Now, so when with regard to the actual event, hold on. Now, with regard to the day itself, with regard to, it says he came on that day. He came on that day to do his work. And plain meaning is to do his work in the house. So Rabbi Shmuel, Rashi says, Chadama Malachto Mamish, one says literally, he didn't have any bad intentions, Yosef. The Chadama Lasos Trach of Ima. And one says, no, Lasos Malachto is a euphemism for his work with her. That means, according to him, he's saying that Yosef, even though he kept refusing, but inwardly he did have a desire for her. And that he came on that day with, I guess on some level, there was an intention. Well, if a person wants something, he puts himself in that position, and one thing leads to another, and before you know it, it's too late. And then the person doesn't, I didn't intend to do it, I just came to work. And then one thing led to another. But what happened was Elishaniris lo demustiokno shalaviv. But there came to his mind the image of his father, as the Gemara and Sota. So in other words, according to this view, Yosef, in point of fact, did not sin, but he had to be saved, so to speak. That he was in a vulnerable position, and on his own he wanted to give in. But suddenly, the image of his father, and the fact that he would not be part of that, in terms of the, his position in Klal Yisrael and so forth, and that prevented him from sinning. Now, the Rambam learns quite differently, because he speaks about Kiddush Hashem and Yisodei HaTorah. I believe it's chapter 5, and he says that if a person does a mitzvah, different types of Kiddush Hashem. Primarily is when a person, sacrifices his life rather than violate certain mitzvahs of the Torah, like Avodah Zarah. So he says, if a person does a mitzvah or refrains from an avera with the purest of intentions, not because of any type of extraneous fear or cause, merely because of his love of God, he says, and he gives the example, like Yosef's restraint from the wife of Potiphar. So he says, that itself is a Kiddush Hashem. So now you see that there's, but that's not what the rabbis are saying. That is not what the rabbis are saying. The rabbis are saying that no, quite the contrary. That indeed he had a desire to do it, and he probably would have done it, but this, the image of his father stopped him. That's not what the Rambam is saying. So the first, well, that's Rav and Shmuel. So you see, well, even you see that they have a dispute on that. But that's a midrash which is giving an interpretation of what's going on. And given that it's not, I think that also substantiates the point. But that's not something he received from Sinai. That's his own understanding of all the factors. Now the Rambam goes through the story, and he has his understanding of all the factors, and he came to a different conclusion. So we see that there are different types of midrashim. As I said, some of them are just an opportunity, like we read in the Mora. The rabbis, it has nothing to do, it's not in any way intended to explain the verse, but the verse lends itself to attaching to it a moral idea, which will make it easy for people to recall in a time of need. Then there are midrashim, which are intended to be interpretation. Now, once it's interpretation, it could be intended as the literal meaning, or it doesn't have to be the literal meaning, it could be the interpretation. Because there's no, I mean, the literal meaning is he came to the house to do his work. That's the literal. What is a psychological state of mind was, that's interpretation. So, and I think we see that whatever the case may be, as long the fact that it's a midrash, and even if it's an interpretation, and even if there's no argument pertaining to it, it's not based upon a received tradition from Sinai, from Moshe Rabbeinu. For if that were the case, then of course it would have to be accepted. And there'd be no room for all the various interpretations that we have that don't accept it, disagree, give a different interpretation. So that's basically what I set out to do. If there's any questions or whatever, go right ahead. The one that we were talking about with the Simanim, that could be taken as an interpretation of what actually occurred, of how it happened, how it went down, as they say. And I say that it's very complicated, very hard for me to accept that because of the questions. But I say even if you don't accept that as how it came about, it still has great value in terms of conveying teachings.